Well, I met Carl Ketcherside some years ago. Was impressed because he did have a magnificent personality. He was that kind of person. The brethren at Columbia asked me to speak on the topic of Ketchersideism in one of our studies there. And I felt like I didn't touch the top side or bottom of it, really, because, like you said, there's a lot of material. But it is on the internet, I suppose it is, yet. And Shahe Gurjan told me that they had had 50,000 hits on that material. And that's more than anything else that they have online.
Yeah.
So that tells you something of the popularity of the man.
He's, he's still a very popular individual. I do believe that it's among more liberal people. I don't know that his teaching affects the church that much today, because it's, you know, you can tell a tree by its fruit, and people look to see what occurred, not only to where Carl Ketcherside ended up, but those churches that he was associated with. They're, you
right.
know.
About ours, you know, the Apostle Paul said, those that are no longer with us, they were not of us. For if they had been of us, no doubt they would have continued on with us.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Brother Richard. That was very good. In the line of preachers, you can trace Carl Ketcherside back to Benjamin Franklin and his influence, because Franklin influenced Sommer and Sommer Ketcherside. In Franklin's writing, in his question and answer column in the American Christian Review, and in his book, I think it's Gospel Preacher, Volume 1, when he was commenting on the basis of unity among Christians, he said that the basis of unity was no doctrinal position. It was faith in the man, Jesus Christ. And you can read that in his question material. Now, we wouldn't consider Benjamin Franklin to be a liberal like Carl Ketcherside, but he did say things like that. A lot of the restorers did. A lot of the restorers said that the creed of the church was, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And that was the only statement of faith that ancient Christians had. So what do you think was the difference, if any, between what those older restorers meant by that kind of language and what Carl Ketcherside later meant when he would say the same thing?
Well, you know, I read things like that, Clint, and I think that maybe, you know, of course, Carl Ketcherside took them and pressed that to the very limit of what their words said, where they wouldn't do that. And if you'd go back and had the ability to question Benjamin Franklin, he might say, that's not the intent of the words I said. You know, the problem that Carl Ketcherside had was, he said, everyone can stay right where they are as far as their conscience is concerned. You one cup people continue to worship with one cup and no Sunday school. You folks that use instrumental music, you continue to use your instrumental music, but everybody just get along with one another and fellowship one another. And for a while, Carl Ketcherside lived and believed and practiced that. He would leave St. Louis and go out someplace and preach, but he always made it back to Oak Hill Chapel there in St. Louis, where he would worship, because he didn't want to worship in some of those places that offended his conscience. But eventually, you know, he kept that saying, telling people that were in denominational or the Christian church or whatever, that they were okay. And eventually, in order to prove that he meant they were okay, he began to do the things that they were doing. And so he lost his identity entirely as to what he believed or didn't believe. He would He would tell me right up until, well, I wasn't around him much. I didn't communicate with him much after 1980. But he would write up to that, and he would say, I still hold the same doctrinal positions. I'm opposed to located preachers. I'm opposed to Bible colleges, even though I go lecture at them. I'm opposed to them. And I'm opposed to church, orphanages and things. But I think that he crossed a line someplace where even though he might have been opposed, his lifestyle didn't show that he was.
I think he was on the slippery slope that he couldn't control. He started down that. I doubt if he ever intended to end up where he landed. But when he started down that slippery slope, he could not control it. And it got farther and farther and farther. Finally, he just had to give it up. He told me the same thing. I asked him about the one-man pastor system. I believe what I've always believed about that, he said. But I just don't make the test of fellowship.
Yeah.
That we wrote one another quite often, and he, in one of his letters, he said, Ronnie, I hear you are calling me liberal. He said, some of my brethren are telling me that you're calling me liberal. I'd like to arrange to come down. I was living in Lebanon at that time, to speak before the church at Lebanon and let y'all question me. And so I wrote him back and told him that I was currently engaged with discussions from the people at Ozark Christian College over these very issues, you know. He said, well, if you brethren are doing that, there's no need for me to come down. But he was conscious of the fact, I think deep down in his heart, he knew that he was moving toward liberalism, but he was trying to justify what he had done on the basis of the fact that we're in fellowship, you know, and we need to overlook those things.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost control of himself, and he just kept going and going and going.
Absolutely. That was the problem. And, you know, he would invite people to come to Oak Hill Chapel that would disagree with. And in those early years, even though he was having this fellowship, thoughts on fellowship, he would invite someone to come, and then he would devour them because they would get up and teach stuff that he disagreed with, but he had them where he had them there in his assembly, and he'd show how wrong they were in the things that they believed and taught. And so I thought that was interesting.
I'd like to make one more comment. You know, as far as how he affected our brotherhood, there's no question he affected our brotherhood. I remember when Irvin Waters debated Van Bonneau in Oklahoma City on the cups and classes. Several of us were riding in a car with Irvin one night. I was in high school, and I had taken a course in high school on the book of Job, and Irvin said, man, I don't believe in that. He said, the church is the only agency to preach the gospel.
Yeah.
High schools can't do that, which was, of course, what Ketcherside believed and what basically Irvin and a lot of our preachers believe. A few years after that, though, after Irvin had been affected by that, I brought that to his attention one day. And, of course, he had changed, admitted he had changed.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, he no longer held the view that only the church could preach the gospel or teach the truth. And in that way, Carl Ketcherside, we lost some preachers over that. And we lost some brethren. Not nearly as many as most of the churches of Christ lost. But Carl did affect a number of preachers among us, and they went down that road, and they eventually, most of them, completely left the church. Now, in Irvin's defense, I think Irvin has come back a long, long way from where he was, and I think he has turned around in many of the areas where at one time he would have been more blatantly in agreement with Carl Ketcherside. I'll just tell you one more thing, then I'll hush. Carl, the city of Ozark's a small town. It's a county seat town, but it's just a small town. And when they had that debate, when he had that debate down there, it was the talk of the entire area because he did whip up on Porter terribly bad. There's no question about that. The people in Springfield, in the
Sunday school churches told me the first time Carl Ketcherside came to Springfield to preach, he was in knee pants.
Yes.
That's what he was wearing at that time. It was a very young man.
Yeah. Well, there's stories about when he would go to preach someplace, and when it'd be time for services, the brethren have to go out and call him to come in because he'd be out playing with the kids and would just, you know, be a young whippersnapper.
Well, I just say, I really enjoyed your talk. It sounds to me like Ireland and Scotland's a place that Church of Christ preachers ought to avoid. Campbell never was the same after he went there either.
Yeah.
But I did want to make the comment, since Ronnie mentioned this, Irvin has come back a long way from where he was, but his position on fellowship is still the same as it was when he left us. And he told Benny Cryer that specifically not very long ago.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring something up that bothers me about this whole thing, is that and I want to preface it by saying we have some very intelligent men in the building tonight.
Yes.
However, it bothers me as you talk about Carl Ketcherside that such intelligent men, and we could even say the same thing modern times, such intelligent men would go down a path like that. Do you have any comments on that? Or you talked about the emotional thing that he had on that one time. I just wonder if you had any comments on that.
Well, of course, you know, I think that his change was brought about because of all of the, I mean, if you read the papers, the journals from the 1940s and 50s, there's debates being advertised in you know, every part of the country. And if there's not a debate being advertised, there's one being challenged. And brethren were feuding over doctrinal issues. And this bothered Carl Ketcherside, even though he was, you know, one of the ringleaders of that. It began to bother him. And it bothered him, I think, because that he saw the Sommer family so ripped apart with division. And then he gets over to England, and the brethren in England are saying, you know, first of all, they had received lots of letters from the churches that support colleges and orphanages saying, don't let Carl Ketcherside preach or be among you. And their attitude was, we'll let whoever we want to preach if he's been, you know, a member of the Church of Christ. And so they invited him to preach, and they told Carl Ketcherside that if some of those brethren that are, you know, the college people come over, we'll let them preach. And Carl's trying to mull this over in his head and figure it out. And I think it just came to him that, you know, unity, the expression unity and diversity is the only way to have unity. That's what he thought. And so he embraced that and came back to the U.S. and started preaching it, writing about it. But it didn't work. It didn't work because he always had to give. You know, the Christian church people didn't want to make concessions to him. The Baptists didn't want to make concessions to him. He had to make the concessions all the time. Yeah.
I think one of the things at play here, for years, Carl had really beaten up on the mainline churches of Christ because of the pastor system, the colleges, the orphans' homes, and they couldn't handle him in debate. There's no two ways about that. I think Johnny and I both heard him when he debated Flavel Colley every night in Dallas. And he was very powerful in debate. And they, even though they were against him and they didn't like it, he just absolutely could handle anything they put out. But when he went too far, they saw their chance, and they got the smell of blood,
and they went after him. And in that way, they got even with Carl Ketcherside because he had gone too far, and there was no doubt. They declared war in all the papers on Carl Ketcherside, and he paid dearly, I think.
Richard, this gospel doctrine distinction that he made so much emphasis on.
Yes.
The truth is, that same particular idea is constantly, from time to time, simply dressed up in new words and brought forward to us. And there's several other things, but that basic gospel doctrine difference still floats among us, but it's just put in new dress in a new suit. And we need to recognize how serious it is when you start to make that distinction. Basically, what you've done is you got to Matthew chapter 28, and you just stopped with verse 19. And the rest of the New Testament.
Yes.
And after you do that, before long, you're going to start to try and find some way to even find those people who have not been baptized. You'll find some concept to try and take away baptism.
Yes.
And you'll move your way right back to the doctrine of faith only. And where are you when you do that?
Yeah.
And I think behind the gospel doctrine, that's one of the basic roots. And we need to be aware of language that hides that very distinction.
You would like explain the difference you made between doctrine.
Well, the view that he had was, you know, Ronnie asked me to explain Ketcherside's view. The view that he had was that the gospel was to be taught to the unbeliever and not to people that have already been baptized. And the folks in the church should only hear doctrine and not gospel. And of course, this went hand in hand with his view of the located preacher. Why would it be wrong to have a located preacher? Well, because they don't need to hear the gospel. And a preacher, all he's supposed to do is preach the gospel. And so if all he's doing is preaching the gospel, why would he be preaching to the congregation? And so Ketcherside made a very sharp distinction when he would be talking to folks about gospel and doctrine. The truth of the matter is, when he'd go to hold a gospel meeting, though, he might teach something that was doctrinal. He was, you know, seemed to me he was inconsistent in what he was saying, but he would say that if you're preaching, well, you're only preaching the gospel. Maybe I didn't say that well enough, but...
You know, one of the terms that Brother Ketcherside used a lot after he started down his path of liberalism and open fellowship was he would talk about brethren in prospect.
Yes.
That was the term he used, and what he was talking about was people who had not been baptized for the remission of sins.
Yes.
And so, you know, we... To echo what Ron is saying, when people start talking about who used to be among us, the point of salvation is faith and not baptism, they're going down that same road. And if they keep following that path, they'll be back there at faith only, and they'll be talking about essentially brethren in prospect. That is, their fellowship will open up to... nice people who believe in God and Jesus, but who have not been baptized.
Mm-hmm. You know, his change occurred. There was a lot going on. Those of us that are older remember the events. Those of you that are younger, but you remember Pat Boone, you know, was in that same time period when Ketcherside was, you know, right at his peak on his fellowship thing. And Pat Boone had that deal where he left and went towards Pentecostalism. And so the churches of Christ were just in an upheaval with all sorts of change that was going on.
I just wanted to make a comment. You talked about the debate that he had with Rube Porter, and it's been brought up again. A while back, I was talking with Brother Clint France about institutionalism. It's something I hadn't studied at the time very much, and he had recommended that debate to me. And I hunted everywhere I could and couldn't find a copy of it, and finally found it in an old dingy PDF file. And I took that and I restored it and reprinted it. And the reason I reprinted it was because I thought it was an outstanding debate on the issues and really brings some clarity to the issues. And you hear the Bible colleges issue debated, which not many people, as you say, took the position Ketcherside did on the Bible colleges, and he brought some clarity to both issues. And I think it's a good debate that people need to read and to get back familiar with. I suppose he quit printing it because he didn't believe in debating anymore, and the Gospel Advocate folks and everybody, they didn't want to see it printed either, and it kind of fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent debate, and I think our folks need to get reintroduced to reading debates in general, to see both sides of an issue discussed and to be able to follow the questions and the arguments throughout and to see what comes of truth.
Well, even if you don't want to read the entire debate, if you want to know what the truth is on a particular issue, such as institutionalism, you ask somebody, you know, what's a good debate and who took the right side. You read the affirmatives or what you read the statements that the right man's giving. You learn a lot. And then if you want to read the other, you can. But sometimes, you know, I'll just be going through and I want to read just what, you know, the points are that I, you know, understand is the right side, and I get a pretty good view of it. If I think that there might be a weakness in something, I'll go back and see what the other man has to say.
Brother Richard, if I remember right, Carl Ketcherside did not believe in copywriting any of his material.
That's right.
None of his books were copyrighted. And I remember Brother Jerry Cutter telling me one time, I think he picked up a little old booklet or pamphlet that I had printed, and I had put copyrighted on the back of the title page. And he gave me a mild rebuke about that, and he told me, he said, you know what, if this is the truth, why are you copywriting it? Why don't you just write the truth, and if somebody else can take it and copy it and preach it or, you know, pass it along, let them do it. If it's the truth, why are you copywriting it to prevent somebody else from using it freely? And, you know, that had an effect on me, and I felt like that was right. And, you know, I understand the idea of men needing to be reimbursed for their expenses on printing a booklet or whatever. They need to recover their expenses if they can printing that. But I think that a lot of times with our sermons and our material that we have, it would benefit people very greatly if they could get it for free off the internet, or could freely copy it and mm-hmm. pass it along to somebody else. But we're like women with a recipe. We don't want anybody to have it. We're going to save it. Our sermon or our article just for us, and nobody else can have it. And if we hear of somebody else preaching our sermon, you know, how dare them? Well, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, that's one, at least one little lesson that I took away from Carl Ketcherside, but mostly from Jerry Cutter over that.
I will say there's more than just the reason when we talk about copywriting things. I mean, I share your sentiments, and I, you know, in principle, I agree with you, but copywriting does more than just prevent someone else from profiting off of your material. It prevents them from altering it with your name on it where people think that you're teaching something that you're not. In other words, if somebody picks up a tract that George Batty's written and they decide to redo it, but he's got a few things that's wrong here they're going to fix, and they still got your name on it, that's a violation of a copyright law if someone does that. And you can, well, not if it's a brother in Christ, but you can call him up and say, you know, you've done something that's wrong, and you can tell brethren. That's called plagiarism. It's a different thing.
When I came to Hamilton and held a meeting, I preached material from a book that I had read that I thought was very good. And Jim Rogers came up to me after service. He said, boy, he says, that was a good lesson. He said, where'd you get that? Implying there is no way you could have come up with such material. And so I confessed to him the book that I had gotten it from. And I said, well, you know, I will have to admit I did get this from this book. And he said, when you take material from just one source and preach it, he said, that's plagiarism. But he said, when you take it from several sources, that's called research.
So how did Ketcherside view those Bible readings in light of his distinction between gospel and doctrine? Because those Bible readings were primarily for church members, weren't they?
Yes.
And he was a preacher, an evangelist, holding Bible readings. I just wondered, did he ever address that inconsistency?
He was an elder at a very early age. I think I told you that he was ordained as an elder, didn't I? That was before his children would have obeyed the gospel.
I'd like to reply to George just a minute. Published it and left the majority of my material out of it. And he mailed me a copy of it. I didn't like that, but what I didn't like even more than that, he had a picture of me on the front with my tongue hanging all the way down. But anyway, I went to see a lawyer just to find out a few things. And I asked him, I said, is it lawful for him to publish this when he's knowingly left out part of what I've said and a lot of things that were a part of the debate? Well, he said, I'm not really equipped to know that. But he said, there's a lawyer in St. Louis that specializes in that. I stayed all night with you, by the way, when I came up there to see that lawyer. So I went up to see this lawyer in St. Louis. The interesting thing, neither one of them ever charged me a penny, neither lawyer. But I told him what had happened. I said, what recourse do I have? He said, I'll write him a letter. He did, and boy, that guy cashed in right quick, and it was all over with. He just wrote him a letter, and he put a stop to him publishing that. But that, by the way, is another value of a copyright.
Yeah.
Okay, is that everybody? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess. In the last couple years or so, I've had some correspondence with a guy named Phil Sanders in Oklahoma City, who wrote a book on postmodernism. And we've had an opportunity to talk about, you know, Carl Ketcherside and some movements that have gone through. And I think I remember as a preacher starting out preaching in California, you know, there was some brethren who got off on the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit movement had an impact, I believe, on some of those movements at that period of time. Do you think that is just to say that the switch from a pragmatic, from a position of truth is how you determine doctrine, to a more subjective kind of view, and a more of a turn toward the feeling idea that, that Pentecostalism brought about. Do you think that that kind of laid the fertile ground for that those ideas to take root at that time? And I'm not sure if I really am saying it correctly, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure if I understand it correctly either, but certainly, you know, that was a period, a time period, during Ketcherside's departure from some conservative views. There were a lot of people within the mainline churches of Christ and within conservative churches of Christ that were being led astray with their views on the Holy Spirit. And I don't know if I want to blame Carl Ketcherside for that, or if it's just, it was sort of phenomena that was occurring.